Good jobs, quality jobs.
We still have so much to do for women's rights.
For the parents to go to work, you need good childcare.
We will not have a successful recovery if we leave social rights.
Reinventing our way of building and living.
It is our right.
Hello and welcome to this very special edition of Eurofound Talks. This year is the European Parliament elections, which are taking place in June. It's also election year across the globe. We see major milestones in the United States, but of course in many other countries also. We've seen a lot of changes since the last European Parliament elections, and we will no doubt see more. The idea for us today is to really look at how these changes are shaping our lives. How will democracy respond to this? And can we see in the changes that have happened over the last period, how they've affected Europeans and how they're going to vote? And what are the attitudes that they will take to the poll? And indeed, what does that mean for the future shape of the European Union? So today I'm really very happy to be joined by our own director, Ivailo Kalfin, who himself is a former policymaker. He's been a deputy prime minister and also foreign minister in his native Bulgaria, and joined also by a Bulgarian compatriot, Ivan Khrushchev, who is a political commentator and, dare I say, provocateur when it comes to certain things to do with strategizing and how the developments in the political world are emerging. So very welcome to you both.
Thank you. And you should make it clear that provocateur is kind of a not paid job.
Well, today we're certainly not paying Mr. Khrushchev for his insights, but we hope he will give them to us all the same. So, Ivan, can we start off firstly? Eurofound is preparing its next work programme, 4 years, where we look at how we can assist policymakers in providing evidence and advice, analysis on how to shape better living and working conditions for Europeans. But of course, our decision as to what we research is based on many mega drivers: climate change, geopolitical change, technological change, demographic change. But I would like you here to focus on the geopolitical change. What do you see coming down the tracks, and how is that going to impact on the voters of in June and of tomorrow? Perhaps you can just set the scene a little bit for us.
Yeah. Listen, I'll start with what you already have underlined. This is a very special year. People living in 4 billion people, countries with 4 billion people are going to vote this year. So we're interested in European elections, American elections, but India has been voting. Taiwan has been voting. So, and at the same time, you basically have two wars around. So this kind of relations and this type of dynamics and interdependence between wars and elections is something that is basically affecting these years. Because on one level, certain things that is happening in electoral politics is very much affecting what is happening on the battlefield. But sure. Also what is happening in the battlefield, particularly in Russia, Ukraine, is going to affect basically how people perceive the future, how they are voting. What we can expect from this year's elections is that, at least on the base of the data that we have, and I know that I'm in a place where you have a lot of
data.
is that we can expect that basically turnout is going to be quite high. People are interested in politics. People have felt very much more confused of a world that is changing very fast. And in a certain way, the world that is changing into the directions that we didn't want it to change. Because to a great extent, the end of history wasn't the title of an American book, but it was kind of a European dream. We basically believe that we know where the world is going and we know how it is going to develop. I'm going to just put three things that I found as the major trends that we are going to see. Unfortunately, this kind of a backlash against globalization and in economic level, the rise of much more economic protectionism is going to be certain things that we're going to see. So deglobalization, at least on some level, is going to stay, regardless of the fact that, of course, the economies are not going to decouple. Basically, the level of interconnectedness is going to stay, but this is not the trend, which also means that many of the institutions of the globalized world that we know are going to be in a much weaker position than they have been. Secondly, while there was a lot of talk about the return of bipolarity, particularly with the United States-China confrontation, in my view, we're not going to be back to the bipolar world, which we're much more seeing is a combination of polarization and fragmentation. And one of the most important second trend is the rise of the middle powers. Listen, middle powers is a strange group of people. They have a lot of things in common, but also there are many things that basically make them very different. This is a country like India, but this is also a country like Brazil, but you have even of smaller countries like Saudi Arabia, who because of very specific reasons are playing an important role in their parts of the world. But they have three things in common, all these middle powers. First, they're not strong enough to shape the world order, but they're going to be the most active participants. They're going to be hyperactive. And they go in a different directions, and they're going to compete with themselves. And what they're really going to fight is relevance. And what is central for them is the idea of sovereignty. The second thing that is, in my view, going to be important for this group of people is that they do not want to take side in the confrontation between the United States and China. So they're going basically to have a different strategy of hedging, which does not mean that they're going to be non-aligned, but probably they're going to be partially aligned. So if the Cold War coalitions were really like Catholic marriages, so this is going to be much more open marriages. What you're going to see, and India is a great example in its relations with the United States. And the third, and this in my view is very important, is that probably on the financial level, you're going to have the world which is going to be marked much higher interest rates than basically you have before, which is going to have a very direct
impact
for the things that you're studying so actively here.
Yeah, that's fascinating. In fact, just to refer back to that middle powers issue, I mean, you talked earlier in some of your work about Europe coming to terms or realizing that this really was a changed world, that it was no longer the center of the world, and that Europe had to adapt to that by realizing it was vulnerable to be shaped by other models. Can you just kind of elaborate a little bit on that?
Listen, there are certain things that, in a certain way, does not need to be taken tragically, but they're the reality. Demographically, the number of Europeans in the world are going to shrink, not to increase. And from demographic point of view, we're going to see a major changes because these data are not sure how much we know about the democratic transition, but about demographic transition, we know quite a lot. And we know that basically when the countries become slightly richer, and particularly when the women get much more education, you have the decline of the fertility rate. At the same time, of course, even before it, you have very much the decline of mortality rates. But there is one continent in the world in which you have a dramatic decline of the mortality rates, while the fertility rates is still high, and this is Africa. As a result of it, in the year 2100, according to the demographic projections, 4 billion people are going to live in Africa. Mm. Africa is going to have a population several times higher than the population of Russian Federation. So I'm saying all this because this is a totally different story. Secondly, you have the climate, and this is a major story, not simply because this is going to affect everybody, but because it is going to affect everybody in a very asymmetrical way. And we can expect quite a lot of movement of people. And by the way, there are places of the world that we're seeing that are going to be very much places like Bangladesh or some of the islands, which are very well known that they're threatened. But again, talking about the Russian Federation, keep in mind that the territory of the Russian Federation, 40% is a frozen land. So basically, we're also going to have unfreezing in places like Siberia and others. So one level, you're going to have a new agricultural land that is going to be allowed. But on the other, all the infrastructure that you're going to be there is going to be totally destroyed. So this is going to be a major, major change. And certainly, unfortunately, what we are seeing is that we're going to see also a period with a very much rising defense budgets. And this is going to be a very strong pressure. How it works or not works. I'm afraid that in the next 10 years, we're going to see the spread of the nuclear weapons, because now for many countries, nuclear is becoming the synonymous for sovereignty. And this is already a world. And for Europe, the biggest story is where we in all this. We're losing some of our advantages because basically now technological change is so big that even if you manage to get certain level, you're basically losing it in 1 or 2 years because the next level is coming. So Europe is going to strive for relevance. And this is going to strive for relevance in the world, which is going to be much more hostile to Europe, because for historical reasons, some of the new rising states basically see some of the European countries as a former colonial powers. Secondly, Europe should try to deal with the pressure of shrinking and aging population. And here the problem of migration, but it's not simply migration of how many people are coming, but how are you integrating them? Mm-hmm. How are you making them productive? So the problem of social cohesion is going to be a huge problem for Europe. And then politically, honestly speaking, and here Macron is right, European Union should not be taken for granted. Mm-hmm. In a certain way, they have very different trends. And in a certain way, for the European Union to survive and to remain relevant, some major changes are going to come. So probably for Europe, this is going to be the most decisive decade. Mm-hmm. Since the moment of its foundation.
Well, that's a little bit, Ivailo, just to ask you there on the, I mean, we know there's been an awful lot of activity and debate around this recently with President Macron speaking out. We've got the letter report, Draghi coming up, von der Leyen's speech coming up. You know, is this a pivotal moment for Europe? Will we really be seeing radical change? Will we be looking at a fifth pillar to the single market, for example? What do you see coming down the tracks?
Whether we can call it a pivotal stage, I'm not sure, but this is a very rapid change which is happening. If you say pivotal, that's happening once. Mm. I'm afraid that we have to accommodate to this speed of the changes around us. And as Ivan mentioned, Europe has to realize that we are competing. So, of course, Europe has to react. There are two ways to react, the proactive way and the defensive way. If we see that, for example, Chinese industry, take the electric car industry, etc., is shifting the market, only defensive policies are not going to be helpful. So Europe has to find its way to keep being a leading economy, to keep attracting talents, which means to be a good place to live and to work at. And that's not an easy task because it requires changes. I mean, if we want to keep the leadership in Europe, that means a restructuring of the industrial base, the restructuring of the economy. Mm. So with what Eurofound is very much researching, where the labor is going to come, where the skilled workers are going to come. Do we need migrants and what type of migrants and how the whole migration process is managed?
Yeah.
Because as Ivan mentioned it, it's very likely that this is stimulated by climate change, by droughts in Africa or by natural disasters in other parts of the world. So how Europe reacts to that? I mean, what we do with these people. And then if you want to really find the added value of Europe, and I think that this is the very strong point and core of Europe. I mean, everything that at member state level you cannot do should be done at European level. Mm. But that means coherent societies. Which means, indeed, public services, social policies that don't leave pockets of marginalization on whatever criteria, income, education, living standards, etc. If you want to really have a cohesive society, which by itself is a challenge in the era of digital communications and atomization of the society. Everybody focused on the digital media rather than on what we could do commonly.
I think, though, when we talk about change, there's change that's ongoing that we can see coming down the tracks that you're outlining. But there are also the changes that we know have happened and that we've seen impacting Europeans here in particular. And if I could just take us back a little bit to kind of the prospect of the elections. You've described that as five tribes when you look at the different challenges Europeans have faced. Can you just outline them? Because I'm very interested in talking about how those different tribes respond differently to voting and the trends that we're seeing emerging there.
Yeah, listen, the story is that for the last 15 years, and you're totally right, we always talk about the crisis which is going to come. But the crisis that we have experienced is shaping us. And there was five very important crises. All of them have been pan-European. All of them basically has an existential meaning for every European citizen. And all of them also has a very strong impact on the performance of the European institutions. They basically created an institutional response which was very much out of the box. And the first is climate, which has become kind of critically important in many respects. And the European Commission and the last 5 years were very much basically also shaped by this. Then, of course, you have the economic crisis, which started 2008, 2009, but then it has a different evolution and forms. It started very much as the crisis of the common currency, but then now it was much more take the form of a low growth levels and basically inflation and so on. And then you have the migration crisis, which basically started 2015, but in a certain way, this is not a crisis that is going to end easily. You have COVID and you have the war. And in a certain way, all of them are never-ending crises. So this is not a crisis that you can say, we solved it. By the way, Europe managed to cope with them and in a certain way to tackle them in the way which was surprisingly effective for many. But they're crises which are all the time returning. And as a result of it, when European Council of Foreign Relations, we try to see how people are seeing the future very much based on answering one simple question. When you think about the future, which of these five crises you see as the most important? Because the difference between the trends that we talk about and this crisis is they're based in real experience. Things has happened to people.
To real people.
It's not about what they're reading. It's basically what they learn from their experience. And there you're going to see that these five tribes, by the way, they're kind of equal size, some slightly bigger than the others. But on the other side, they're very much kind of different on their geography. If you're seeing that in the countries like Poland or Sweden, the war in Ukraine is something that is very much capturing the imagination. And particularly in places like Estonia, 60% of the people believe that this is the type of crisis that worries them when they think about the future. But then you see, interestingly, about COVID, because there in the COVID tribe, you're going to see two different types of people. One who believe that our medical and health systems are not prepared enough for the next type of pandemics, and they're worrying about this. But you have people that experience very much COVID also, kind of the arrival of a new type of a much more aggressive government, much more authoritarian government. So there is a very strong anti-vaxxer group for whom this is a very important experience, but it's much more political experience than a medical experience. When it comes to migration, it's also very interesting because migration and climate are the two tribes that very much predicts how you're going to vote. If you believe that the migration is the biggest issue, and by the way, in Germany now, this is a number one issue by far, this is the biggest tribe, it means that you're going to vote either for the far right or for the center right at best. And if you basically declare climate as a major issue, you're going to see the vote much more going on the left. And this is important because they are not simply country divisions, they're also generational divisions. They're divisions based on education. So as a result of it, these five tribes, they're going to have a different vote. By the way, they're going to vote differently in different places. But there is one thing that I found quite interesting. And by the way, with the migration tribe, you also have two groups. The ones who much more fear the people who are going to come, and the other much more kind of worried about our own people who live in our own countries. And this is particularly true for some of East European countries like my own, but it's also true for countries like Italy.
And they're worried about the brain drain.
1 million Italians has left the country since the financial crisis, and you look around and said, my young people are living. Is it okay? So I'm saying this because these people are not basically, these tribes are not going to be subscribed for a certain vote for sure. But of course, the migration is really very much shaping the imagination of the right and the climate very much the imagination of the left. And what is very important for both of them is that both of them believe that there is no time, that we are living on a borrowed time, and as a result of it, not much space for compromises.
That the clock is ticking.
The clock is ticking, yeah. And this type of a ticking clock is something that makes also political process much more difficult because you have a lot of intensity. And keep something in mind about democracy. On the elections, you have representation of different things, interest, values. There is one thing that is never represented in an election night, and this is the level of intensity. You who care very much about the issue, and me who does not care much, both of us has one vote. And as a result of it, this intensity is going to be much more seen on the streets. It does not basically rely so much on the numbers. They try to show how strongly they care about certain issues, which is also going to shape politics.
Ivailo, that's something I know you slightly, Ivan has said before, that he actually doesn't believe to mobilize these European voters, the same people who have a vote each, who are those who agree or disagree, that it's important to maybe steer clear of the success stories of the European Union. I mean, I think that there's an agreement elsewhere that to highlight what the European Union has done is a positive thing to show the successes. That being said, what's very disappointing from the research that Ivan has looked at is that it shows, in fact, that all of these tribes, in fact, seem to think that the European Union's value added has not been significant, that it has not been that positive. Why do you think these things are not resonating with citizens?
Oh, because there is a very odd story of the European Union that national governments very much like to present all the successes as their successes, and all the problems are sent to Brussels and to the European institutions. But if we look what happens again, I mean, if we search, and I think it has to be constantly on our radar. I mean, what is the value added of Europe? What could be done better at European level than at national level? There are plenty of good examples. I mean, take, for example, this instrument that came out of nothing with the COVID crisis and the lockdowns, which was the deepest economic downturn since the Second World War. I mean, it was minus 5.6% of the European GDP. It was recovered in less than 2 years, in about a year and a half. Unlike the previous crisis, 2008, which took more than 6 years to...
Yeah.
And it was a smaller crisis. What is the answer? How this happened? This happened by an instrument which was created and rapidly deployed by the European Union, which supported 32 million jobs across Europe in the conditions of lockdowns. Mm. So the stable labor market and the jobs kept, instead of in the atmosphere of this whole uncertainty we had about COVID, how long it's going to last, how dangerous it is, how we are going to live further, can we at all return to the normal life, etc., etc. If you put on the top of that 32 million unemployed or maybe less, then that would be a disaster in Europe. This disaster was prevented not by national efforts, it was prevented by European efforts. So this is one of the examples. There might be much more. I mean, not to talk about the climate policy, etc., etc. Mm. I mean, you have a limit of the national efforts. And the narrative has to be there. The same with migration. Yes, migration is a very important topic for quite a lot of societies, I would say. Maybe in some countries, as Ivan said, and what the European Council for Foreign Relations finds in some countries, it's much more important than other issues. But that's important for across Europe. What we find, for example, in Eurofound's research is that there are good examples. Ukrainian refugees, 40% among them are at labor. And indeed, they are working at places very often below their qualification, but very much needed for the economies of this country. So there is a way to look positively and to see how migration could be managed, rather than to provoke this far-right sentiments against anybody who is foreigner, because these people can bring value to your country. But again, that has to be European policy, and it cannot be only national policy.
Yeah. And I mean, that's kind of the issue here, isn't it? I mean, what Ivailo is basing his arguments on is evidence-based. We know that the reaction at the European level to the COVID crisis was much more successful. We have evidence and facts to show that, how it has impacted on people's lives in a positive way. Not clearly COVID itself, but the response to it. But what you're saying is that by fanning the sort of the wings of the far right in terms of emulating these policies with respect to migration, in talking about the successes, in highlighting the European Union as a positive, that perhaps we're sort of buying into something which could have a negative response for us if we're not looking for this kind of far right reaction. Can you explain that just a little bit?
No, try. But listen, people are not research institutes. They live with feelings, with information or disinformation, but also they live with their fears, with their anxiety. And listen, European Union, I very much agree, has achieved quite a lot, particularly this policy during the COVID period. But if you compare, for example, the economic post-COVID growth, United States versus European Union, you're going to see that the United States are very much outperforming. And then the story was they also gave the money, but they decided to give the money directly to the people and not to keep the jobs. So the story is, who is doing better? And in my view, you cannot answer this question like this because they're very different economies. They're very different traditions. Everything is totally...
And then the energy crisis hit Europe, not the US, totally. Which is a major factor.
So what I'm saying is people are on one level understanding, and this is why you don't have anti-European sentiments. You don't have type of Euroscepticism, which was so typical for 2017, 2019, after Brexit, after the migration crisis. People don't believe that their nation state is going to make it. They're simply not sure that even European Union can make it. It's much more Euro-pessimism than Euro-skepticism. And secondly, many of the things that are happening is very difficult for ordinary person to try to really have an independent judgment how it works. Things like climate. On one level, Europeans are not in denial of climate change. This is not basically the American right. But on the other, the moment when you push people and go into their everyday life and try to tell them, for example, this is you're not going to buy the old engine cars anymore. You should change your boiler and so on. They said, what you're doing? I give you a mandate to change the world. I didn't give you a mandate to change my life. And this is contradiction, which is at the center of every politics. And the problem with migration is, by the way, the migration is changing. A new consensus is emerging in Europe. One is when the crisis started in 2015, the clash was between people who believe in the open borders and people who basically believed in a fortress Europe. Both of these parties are dead. Nobody believes that you simply can open the borders and nobody believes that you can close the borders. The problem now is whom you welcome. And here the problem is very much that we talk about refugees, but what we really want is a economic migrants, secondly, how to do it, and certainly there is a capacity issues, because in some countries, and Poland and Germany now are example of this, this is not that public is going kind of a racist or that they're doing this and that, simply they reach certain level of capacity which they need the time to digest, because there is a problem when it comes to the health institutions, there is a problem when it comes to the educational institutions. So people need to adjust, and I like the idea of adjustment very much. We believe that we are changing the world by having a plan for a different world, which we're going to realize. But I do believe more and more the problem is who is going to be the more adaptive?
Yeah.
Who is going to better adjust to a world which is changing beyond our plans and beyond our wills? And European Union, of course, has a much more capacity than any of the member states. But when people are voting, and this is the reality, they vote much more with their fears. And what people really hate is when governments are telling them, you're doing well, you don't know how well you're doing, you don't know how well we have done it, because this is the moment in which you're losing the voter, even if you have an evidence for this.
And also when your power, as you say, is equal to everybody else's.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I mean, Ivana, coming back to our own work on this, we do see that from the most recent report on social cohesion, we know that when people are faced with crises, they tend to engage more in the system, but it's more with protest than it is with vote. We also see that with rural and urban divide, we're seeing more rural citizens saying, you know, that they're not less engaged, they're less kind of inclined to vote. What can we do to mobilize people in the right way without telling them that everything is good?
There is something very strange if also we look at our e-surveys during COVID. Actually, when COVID hit, which was a crisis that hit all the member states, all the citizens at the same time, unlike the financial crisis, which had different implications in the different member states. So at that point, the trust of the citizens in the governments was much higher. I mean, they were expecting that governments, including the European institutions, take measures. Somebody has to take measures. Somebody has to preserve us from this crisis that is unexpected. We don't know how this is going to develop, how this is going. And then with the time, and I think, I mean, of course, there might be different ideas, but more or less the reaction was successful, efficient of this crisis, both at national and at European level. In some cases, there was some overreaction, probably, but at the end of the day, this process was under control. The thing is that when it became under control, then the confidence in the government governments went down. So people need governments when they're threatened, when they're not secure, when they feel that there is a problem coming, but they don't cannot assess the size of this problem. And that's why also in this report, Sophia found that you mentioned, we are trying to see what are these divides. And I absolutely agree with Ivan. I mean, people are living their own lives. They don't think about global politics, et cetera, et cetera. They want to know what is their healthcare, housing, jobs, kids at school, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is the everyday life of the people. So when we see these big differences, for example, in the report on urban-rural divide, then you can see why farmers are protesting. I mean, there is a very clear explanation. It doesn't have to do only with the European subsidies. It doesn't have to do with the Ukrainian exports in Europe. It has to do that if you are living in a rural area, you are disadvantaged.
Yeah.
You have much less public services, you much have much less perspectives to do whatever else. If you are not engaged in agriculture, then you don't have much other chances, and agriculture is becoming more and more technological, and they don't need labor. So this whole insecurity and the knowledge that 50 kilometers away, if you go to the town, maybe you are going to have better conditions, but then you have the problem with housing, etc., etc. That creates this protest of the people. So this has to be also also understood exactly what are the problems of these people. And at the end of the day, the institutions are there to manage the problems. I mean, to manage, to control the crisis, to manage the problems, and to provide solutions for that.
And Mary, there is something that comes a lot from the research that I have been doing. When there is real fear, governments benefit. When there is an anxiety, protest parties benefit.
Right.
Because anxiety is a diffused fear. You fear too many things. You cannot focus.
You can't pinpoint.
Yeah. And from this point of view, just to support what Ivan said, COVID was a fear was the sentiment that was basically shaping people's expectations and behaviors. We're in a period of anxiety, and anxious people tends to be loud.
Yeah. But that's fascinating because, in fact, that feeds into that whole trust element, the trust in the institutions. And we know that's declined over these different periods. As Ivailo said, when you see responses that are seen to be positive and impacting positive, you see trust increasing. But without good trust, social cohesion breaks down. You have disengagement. You have, I suppose, disconnect from society generally. I mean, what can we do? I mean, apart from communicating, but communicating all good is apparently not the way to go either. But when we're living in this era of disinformation and misinformation, how can we do better? You know, what is the challenge we're actually facing there? When you, as you talk about, anxiety is disparate. It's not focused on one thing. You know, for communicators, for example, help me.
If I knew the answers,
he'd be a rich man.
Going to be a very rich man. But one thing that we know on the basis of some of the studies is that, for example, trust in media in general is very much defined by, do you have a local newspaper? Because when it comes to the local newspaper, people basically should know when they're saying the truth and when not. And when, for example, this was an American data, but when they trust their local newspaper, it tends to believe that they're trusting mainstream media more in general. So one of the most important things, try to communicate based on the experience that personally has firsthand. Because this is where they can really test what you're saying. When we talk to artificial intelligence, I either should trust you or mistrust you. I cannot check any of this. I don't know how it's going to work. Is it going to work this way or that way? And this is why I'm much more ready to trust any charismatic figure who is going to come, either selling me something or trying to scare me to death. So in my view, this divorce between the first-hand experience of the people and the things that we are discussing is so difficult in politics.
Trying to close that gap.
Try to close the gap.
Okay, thank you very much. I mean, I want to wrap up. Usually we do a talk to me in three, sort of at the end of these podcasts. Today we'll talk to me in two, so I'll give you one each. But we've talked about where we are with Europe, pivotal time or a period of great change. It reminds me a little bit of the Leopard of Lampedusa. It seems to me that for everything to stay the same, everything must change. So if you had, the policymakers in front of you that are part of our next College of Commissioners, part of our new European Parliament, you know, what is the critical thing that you would say to them that needs to be adapted for us really to see Europe progress and to change without disrupting everything, but so that we can continue to have the Europe that we all wish for. Ivailo.
Well, I think that what is very important is to communicate properly. I mean, fears create an augmented reality. People start imagining things that do not happen. So if you bring them the facts first, and second, you give them the assurance that there is somebody to take care of these problems. There is somebody to help. There is a care for their individual problems. Then it might work better than speaking some general slogans, how good we are and how we are going to successfully compete.
Okay, thank you, Ivan.
And Maris, the world is really going to change fast. But you are not going to basically succeed by simply telling people that the world is going to change fast. In a certain way, you should think and prepare for the world to change fast, but we should also try to reassure people that governments are in control. Because the fear that governments are not in control is one of the reasons that you have this kind of a very intensive resentment, resentment without a project, resentment without an alternative, but they want to be sure that somebody is in control. So this is my story, reassurance at the same time combined with a clear understanding that the things are going to change very fast. And by the way, they're going to change for us, not only for the others.
So what I'm hearing from you both is to remind ourselves that people are really at the core of the European project, as they always have been from the start. Thank you both for today. It has really been a fascinating exercise to do a quick whirlwind tour of where we are at this very important time for Europe. Eurofan talks many things. Today we went a little bit more global, and I think it's been a really fascinating experience. Thank you to both Ivan Krashtev and to Ivailo for joining us this morning. You can hear all of our other podcasts on Spotify or indeed anywhere else where you actually download your podcasts. They cover trust, for example. They cover sustainable work into the future, and they look at all of the issues related to social cohesion, gender equality, etc., which have been raised today. In the meantime, you can also access the information on our website, and indeed you can look at Ivan Krashtev's work, where he is available also in the New York Times, Financial Times and other media. And until the next time, when Eurofan talks to you.
Good jobs, quality jobs.
We still have so much to do for women's rights.
For the parents to go to work, you need good childcare.
We will not have a successful recovery if we leave social rights.
Reinventing our way of building and living.
It is our right.